Welcome back to the Center for Children, Families, and Workforce Development podcast. I'm Zach Reamer. Today, we're bringing you a great conversation between two experts on the legal side of child protection. Ashley Troutman is a research assistant professor in the School of Social Work at the University of Montana. She graduated from the Master's in Social Work program and the law school here at U of M with a concentration in tribal law. Ashley also serves as a Juvenile Justice Technical Assistance Specialist at the National Native Children's Trauma Center. Ashley spoke to Gaynell Realbird, the Meth Initiative Coordinator and a Child and Family Specialist at the Bureau of Indian Affairs Rocky Mountain Region. The subject of Ashley and Gaynell's conversation was the experience of appearing in court for social service workers in Indian country. I want to jump right into the discussion they had, but I just want to say that if you have ever wondered what goes into the decision to take a child into protective services, you'll find their conversation really eye-opening. If you are a child protection specialist, especially in Indian country, you'll find some of this advice as indispensable information for making your work more effective. All right, so let's just jump right into their discussion. Here's Ashley.
Okay, now I would love to hear just a little bit about what your current position is and how long you've been working for BIA.
Okay, hello, my name is Gaynell Realbird. I am the Rocky Mountain Regional Meth Initiative Coordinator and Child and Family Specialist in Billings, Montana. I have been with the Bureau of Indian Affairs 4 years. The capacity that I really hold near and dear to my heart and which I'm involved in currently is child protection. I do some adult protection, but my focus is child protection. The majority of what I do is I respond to calls where drugs, alcohol, abuse, neglect, sexual abuse, exploitation, all of those factors that are, I guess, I don't want to say rampant, but right now with the meth, the drug methamphetamine is we're at like an epidemic level. And I just completed our annual meth report, and from 2012 to 2016, our referrals went up 445%. Which is huge, and we cover we provide services for 8 reservations, 2 in Wyoming and 7 in Montana, or 6 in Montana, excuse me. And what we do at the regional office is we provide oversight. We're called AOTRs, which is an awarding official technical representative, and what we do is we provide technical assistance and services for funding that we allocate to the tribes and agencies, and then we provide oversight to those agencies and tribes. Part of what I do, we also do as a regional office, is we go on what we call detail. So I am currently detailed to Northern Cheyenne Agency, where I started out, and I'm back doing child protection, and I'll be here for about 30 days, and in child protection in Indian country, we basically hit the ground running. So it's very intense, it's very time-consuming. I've only been here 3 days, and we've already done a forensic interview on one of my clients. I'm currently looking for another little boy. We had a very serious critical incident on Saturday where 6 children, were involved in a very serious incident here on the reservation, and we're just going and moving constantly. And there are right now, currently we have 4 social service reps and 2 child protection social workers, MSWs, and a supervisor. So we just lost the supervisor that was here before. She resigned on February 17th, and that was her last day. So in child protection in Indian country is so hard that we turn around a lot of staff. And so one of the things that we're working on, like at the region, is that we're working on 2+2 programs to grow our own at the some of the reservations. We've Fort Peck, for instance, they have a 2+2 program at their local community college to really grow their own child protection social workers. But we do a lot of that. We provide funding for domestic violence, and so we go in and review the programs to make sure they're doing what they're supposed to be doing. And our emphasis in that is the impact, to reduce the impact of trauma for children who witness domestic violence in the home in Indian Country in the Rocky Mountain region.
Yeah, and I think what some people don't know, and that you've just sort of talked a little bit about, is the fact that, you know, BIA Social Services doesn't just handle child protection. They do a lot of different things, including, you know, the IIM accounts and things like that. So I just think that's, you know, it's just really interesting, and it places a lot of emphasis on the importance of having these really versatile workers who come into your community. So, yeah, and I think the other thing that is interesting is that, as you were discussing, in your role at the regional office, you get detailed to different sites. And so, just from what I know from working with you, Gaynells, I know that you have had the opportunity to work at a few different tribal communities, including Northern Cheyenne and also Crow. So you have a really good sense, I think, of how it is that court and appearing in court might be different for social service workers depending on which tribal community you're practicing in. And so I think it'll be really great to hear your perspective on, you know, just some words of wisdom that you might have for social service workers as they prepare to appear in court, which is something that you do as a social service worker. So, how would you describe a social service worker's role in the court process?
Well, so my background was I had 15 years of tribal court experience, which really helped me become a good social worker. A lot of the workers that we hire don't have tribal court or court experience other than maybe going and paying a parking ticket or doing jury trial, something like that. So it's extremely important because you not only have to know your Code of Federal Regulations laws, which guides the BIA practices and standards, but you also have to be knowledgeable about the tribal law and order code and what the parameters are there. And you have to know all the federal laws in regards to child protection, child neglect in Indian Country. And so there's courts that are different. You have a CFR court that I worked a couple months ago in at Fort Washakie Wind River Reservation. And so their court is a little bit different in regards to, say, the rules of civil and federal procedures compared to, say, like Fort Peck Indian Reservation, Crow Reservation, Northern Cheyenne Reservation, Blackfeet Reservation. They're all uniquely and separately and distinctly different in regards to how they process their paperwork. Say, for instance, one agency does a report to the court and with all the demographics and the situation and what needs to be in the report to the court. Some other agencies provide affidavits to the court, which is basically, you know, a sworn testimony. And then child abuse and neglect doesn't change in Indian Country, but how each social worker needs to know and understand exactly what to expect in tribal court. You have an attorney that will represent you as the agency and process your court report, and then you'll have to testify in court on your initial placement. You know, they call it an emergency placement. And you'll have to really be aware or cognizant of what's going into your report, because that is also subject to discovery. And your justification for removal, you have to have each one of the elements in your code met in order to be able to have reason to remove that child, justification to remove that child. You also have to be aware of parental rights, civil rights, and what are the rights of the parents? What are the rights of the child? And what your role is in balancing all of those and still do child protection. So our role is really to, once we get a referral, you know, when we investigate and if we've substantiated and where there's an absolute need to place this child into protective services, then we have to go and read our law and order code to make sure that we're following everything prescribed in there that we have to make sure is completed and done. And then we have to bring that forth. And that's really our job. And when we write our reports, our affidavits to the court, that we're actually bringing the prosecutor and the judge to that moment. A lot of the social workers sometimes leave out sensory items like the smell, you know, what did it smell like? How cold was it? You know, was the child, you know, how did the child look? Did we do our medical screening? Was that complete? And so we have to know and be aware of those things when we're going into court. So it's just really like a macro view. And then by the time we get into court, you know, it's just really nailing down exactly what was the reason. And so I think social workers should be required to have some type of knowledge of federal Indian law and tribal law incorporated into their orientation process. So they're not, when they're going into the court and say they're being cross-examined by their client or the parent's attorney, you know, that they're really knowing exactly what's in this case, what it entailed, what they've done in the case, and making sure that everything's in their file, from narratives to the referral, photographs, all the demographics, social security cards, everything has to be in that file, you know, in the process when you're doing your assessment, your investigation is really crucial. Because you're not wanting to leave anything out, because you're really focused on the civil portion of it, and you're really not, we're not law enforcement. And a lot, I think, of what happens is we tend to sway on the side of what happened on the criminal part of it. And sometimes that gets us in trouble because we're only focused on civilly what our role is as a social worker in the civil element, not in the criminal element. So that's really important. And you know, if it evolves into something criminal, then you should be able to have knowledge if you're going into MDT cases or by chance, which we don't really ever have to testify, but in case we ever had to testify, we would have to have everything in order going forward in court. So we also respond to sexual assault cases. You know, we respond to suicide. We respond to pretty much anything that has to do with juveniles in Indian country or in the Rocky Mountain region. And so we have to be aware of all like mental health issues, everything. We really have to just be this orb of knowledge to know how to proceed with the cases. And on the legal part of it is one of the most, if not the important factors of how we what knowledge we need, what type of knowledge base we should and that we need to have in order to maintain our cases. We need to know the timelines. We need to know, you know, did we do this procedurally correct? Did we go and get a child at a school and do an interview? And can we do that? I mean, there are a lot of laws that govern us, and we have to be completely, totally, and fully aware of what to do in those cases. And then when we're going into court, say for an adjudication, which is technically a trial, is we have to be prepared with all of our documents on exactly what we did in a chronological order with this family and the child to provide and continue to provide that protection.
So, yeah, there's just, it sounds like there's really a lot that goes into being prepared for court, including just a couple of things that I noted in your thinking about your report to court is ensuring that you have as much detail as you think that would be helpful for the judge to look at, including like what, you know, the condition of the home is. Yeah, and the things that you mentioned, like the smell and the temperature and things like that. And then also being sure that the facts that you list in the report or the affidavit or in chronological order so that it's helpful perhaps for the judge then to really, you know, as you talked about, be there in that moment to be able to understand what happened while a social service worker was in the home doing their investigation.
Right, right.
So, you know, I'm interested to learn, in your experience, any common mistakes that you have seen made in a report to court and a good way to avoid making these mistakes?
So a lot of what they miss are times and dates. The time of the removal, from the time they got the referral to the time they did the removal, or the location. So ours has to be, I mean, we have to have who, what, where, when, and why types of things. So sometimes we're missing an element of where we removed, when we told the parent that we were removing from them, and sort of just easy steps, but when you're in a chaotic situation where there was violence, you know, sometimes you get into the trauma and you could forget a critical element of like, what time did you let the parents know that you were removing these children and placing them into protective care and custody? Sometimes we tend to forget and we get really focused on, like, if there's other kids in the home, sometimes we forget that there, or we don't ask the question of where are the other children, and we only put certain, like, say there's three kids that we remove, but there's seven, so we're not removing all of them. We're only removing the ones that are right then and there, but we should have removed, I mean, put the other kids on the list as well. I've seen the cases be dismissed when, like, for instance, I had a case dismissed that I returned the child to the non-offending parent, but I pushed it through anyway. And once I did that, the judge dismissed the case, but I didn't understand why, because it was a mom. But when the non-offending, and that was when I was first starting, so the role of the non-offending parent, sometimes we forget, you know, that there's another parent. You know, and so that was a case. Sometimes they're missing court dates. Like this morning, we had six kiddos that were removed. The youngest was removed 3 weeks prior to the older children, and so all of those cases weren't managed by one person. They were managed by different caseworkers, and that case got dismissed this morning. So that should have never happened. Getting notice from the court is also really important. So they're in like a marriage. They should be in like a marriage, a contract, you know, a partnership where they're letting us know when court hearings are happening, or sometimes it's lack of someone writing it down on a calendar, which is really important, or they're not getting noticed from the court. And so like this morning, nobody showed up for court and it got dismissed. Or they're not submitting their reports to the court for their reviews in a timely manner, which is normally 5 to 10 days before the court proceeding happens. So in case they have an attorney, then, you know, that discovery happens or whatever, and the judge is really seeing what's being done in the homes. Sometimes they're getting them dismissed because they're not doing what they're supposed to be doing. And we lose sight sometimes of reunification. We, in a lot of the law and order code, it says imminent harm and danger. Well, when the imminent harm and danger is gone, you know, and the parents are back to normal, then what do you do? You know, so we're really, sometimes we're going and we're just, you know, removing, 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 and we're not really, looking at trying to do differential response or some type of intense differential response or something like that, where just sometimes we lose ourselves because, you know, there's not a lot. I mean, like, we don't, like, say you're way out here in the middle of nowhere, you get a call in the middle of the night, 3 a.m., you know, what are you going to do with these kids? But you're, I mean, you've been woken up out of a dead sleep, and then you're having to face this chaotic situation, and sometimes you're not thinking clearly as well either. So I know, I think that a lot of what we could be doing is like using voluntary placements, doing differential response and different things like that. But the court should really be working with us on a lot of these cases, and a lot of them are just getting dismissed because of time frames. They're not meeting their 36 or 72 hour time frames. And so they're getting dismissed. So we have to be aware of when that clock starts ticking. When did you get that referral, and when did you file? And so, you know, we have to be aware that a parent has a right, you know, that if we didn't do what we're supposed to be doing, then we're going to get this case dismissed.
Right. Maybe just because of the nature of the work, or you know, as you're describing, you might be woken up at 3 in the morning. And so it is, and it's those little details that sort of escape notice perhaps, but are really important for report to court and affidavits and when testifying and all of that. So, yeah, so that's helpful advice for sure. So in terms of, so thinking about maybe, you know, the report to court is in, but now a social service worker is getting ready to actually go into court, perhaps for adjudication. What do you think makes social service workers uncomfortable about testifying in court?
Judges, the judges, and the questions that they're being asked. So sometimes it's not scripted. You know, of course it's not going to be scripted, but sometimes they're scared that maybe they didn't do something right and that's gonna, they're going to get caught. I think it's just fear of the unknown, that they've never had to testify in court. They're under oath. They're under pressure. You know, and if the parent is there and, you know, they happen to say something that isn't true, that maybe that would be believed. And so, like in Indian country, especially for some of our area, we have a lot of native language learners that really aren't college educated, and they don't know the English language as well as they wish, you know, as well as they could. So sometimes when they're being asked a question by a trained attorney, they're not really understanding it. And so, like in Crow, the judge speaks Crow to the client or the family. And then, you know, so there's that sometimes, that they're not good public speakers, and they're not trained to speak in public. So there's just that fear, those fears, I think.
Yeah. And so, you know, perhaps this probably be my last question as we wrap up here, but given all of that and what you're describing is what social service workers are really, what makes them anxious, what would you be your advice in terms of the most helpful way to prepare, or how it is that you perhaps have overcome feeling anxious while you testify in court?
Probably knowing my case, knowing exactly what I did, knowing that I crossed every T, dotted every I, and knowing my affidavit, because I wrote that document. You know, and knowing it where I don't have to take that piece of paper up there with me, that I know what time I removed them. I know what time I was called. I know the situation of the child. I know the elements that needed to be met. I know that whether law enforcement was called or not, I know that if I remove that child, I would testify on the justification for the removal because it met every single element, that I didn't miss anything. You know, and it's just that confidence from having experience, you know, talking in public. But, you know, because you're not going to get up there and you're not, like now we're talking and I'm saying a lot. You're not going to do that, because you are going to have, you are the professional sitting in that chair that agency, that that agency is trusting enough to do their job. So we have a lot of responsibility on us, and court is the biggest. That we can't do it without them. So we have to partner, but we have to know, the judge has to know that we know exactly what we're doing, trust us enough, and that our testimonies are solely based on what we wrote in our affidavits and no additives or anything that you're going to, throw out there.
Right. That's very helpful. Thank you so much, Gaynell, for your time and all your words of wisdom that you were able to provide. I think that will be so helpful for social service workers who might be just starting out to hear some tips from you about how it is that they can navigate the court process. So thank you so much again. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Ashley. I probably rambled, but it was good.
Thank you so much.
All right, Ashley, thank you.
Okay, bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
So that's all for the conversation between Ashley and Gaynell, and I hope that you as the listener were able to take a lot of great lessons from Gaynell's experience. I think one of the biggest ones for me was just the importance of really knowing your cases and working hard on being familiar with the details before you even step foot in the courtroom. Thanks again to Ashley Trotman for a really great interview, and to Gaynell Realbird for being, in your words, an orb of knowledge. I love that phrase. I want to thank Ira Wolf for the opening and closing music as well. Now, if you as the listener have any questions or feedback, or if you just know of somebody that might have some really great information that we should interview, send us an email. You can reach out to us at the center at the email address ccfwd@mso.umt.edu. Also, don't forget that our website has more podcast episodes and a ton of amazing resources in one nice centralized location. The website is at health.umt.edu/ccfwd. Again, that's health.umt.edu/ccfwd. And one last big thank you to you as the listener. I'm really glad that you're motivated to work better with your clients every day and that you listen to this episode to glean some knowledge from our experts in the state. Please take care of yourself, and I'm looking forward to having you back for our next episode. See you next time.